Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. Now, on this show, we primarily discuss the news, and that news is inevitably not the lightest of fare. So much like we discussed the geopolitics of Santa's backyard on last year's holiday show, we'll shamelessly use the release of Star Wars this time round to talk about the very real battles that could take place between states in space. The geopolitics of space are made all the more complicated by the fact that the major players aren't exactly on the best of terms. The US, China, and Russia all vie for supremacy in an arena that means so much for observation and communications, with technology up in the heavens very much influencing facts on the ground. To discuss all the questions and complications with me this week is Jim Lewis, head of our Strategic Technologies Program at CSIS.
We've pursued largely national programs in space, in part because of security, in part because of national pride, in part because some of our partners weren't as advanced. And now you're seeing NASA reach out to India. They've had close relations with the French, with the Germans, with the European Space Agency. But there's a limit to what you can do because these places have made decisions about how much they're willing to spend. The main reason people go into space is for prestige, right? That's why politicians pay for it. Tremendous scientific benefit, but it's a prestige activity. It's showing off your wealth, your technological sophistication. And that means it's a form of competition. So with Russia and China, they're competitors. And the question is, can we find a way to cooperate with them? Do we want to find a way to cooperate with them? Right now, the Russians, we depend on them for getting to the space station. That makes everyone uneasy. The Russians are pretty snarky about the space station. They say they built it. It was their idea. And when the current contract is over, they're going to break it in half and take their half and go somewhere else. That doesn't sound like cooperation. The Chinese, they definitely see this as a way to show that they're back on the world stage, that they're a serious major power. They had there's a medal that they call two bombs and a satellite, right? Which is the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, and the first Chinese satellite. This is a tool of diplomacy for them. This is something where they see it as a way to demonstrate to the world, you know, we're back, we're powerful. It's going to be hard for us to cooperate with that. I mean, because one of the people they want to show most that they're back and they're powerful is us.
Well, you look at satellites, spy satellites, observation satellites. You know, they're not a prestige thing. They have actually a lot of use. You know, you can see things happening in real time. There's obviously a lot of military benefit to that. But at the same time, they're extremely fragile because they're just hanging there and they're sitting ducks, so to speak. And, you know, you hear about this happened a couple of years ago, but, you know, the Chinese demonstrating their ability to take down a satellite. Are you afraid that something like that would escalate and that, you know, space could become a war zone?
Well, one change in the last, say, 10 or 15 years is that what you might call reconnaissance satellites from a military perspective or Earth observation satellites have gone from being relatively rare to being relatively common. You have small sats, microsats. You know, think of you put your cell phone camera in orbit, maybe with a little better optics. All of a sudden, you've got an observation satellite. So we've seen a profusion of observation satellites. And that gives you an opportunity to make your system a little more robust, because if we were going to depend on the big Battlestar Galacticas that we've built that have exquisite capabilities, those are easy targets. We know that the Chinese and the Russians have both thought about how do they either destroy them or disrupt them. But if you're depending on a swarm of smaller satellites, maybe you could avoid that. There's problems that come with that as well.
Well, when a ship goes into another ship or there's an accidental collision between aircraft, sometimes there's a response, sometimes there's a means of right. De-escalating, or sometimes it does indeed escalate. Look at Turkey and Russia recently. What do we do in space?
It depends whether you know or not. And so one of the things that the Chinese learned from their 2007 test is, gee, we better be a little more quiet when we test our anti-satellite capabilities. And sometimes satellites will go out of commission. And was it a piece of debris? Was it a solar flare? Was it intentional, an action by another state? Was it a malfunction? You don't know. You're not going to be able to find out. So the problem and the difference is, in many cases, if it's done right, we may not know who was responsible. It could have been an accident. You had a satellite last month that went out of commission, didn't work, and no one knows why. So not one of ours, in other countries. That's the dilemma, is there's many, many ways to interfere with satellites in space services, not all of which provide for the attribution you'd need for diplomatic action or some sort of response.
And speaking of that diplomatic action, are we any closer to any sort of, or would it even be advisable to have some sort of a treaty on space or some sort of international norms that could be laid out, that the rules of the road, so to speak?
We have a treaty. It's been around for about more than 50 years. It was an Eisenhower idea. And it says that space, people won't put weapons in space. This is when people were worried about what they called FOBs, fractional orbital bombardment systems, which were, you can see this in the movie Time Machine in H.G. Wells. They have it in the at the last segment. They have orbiting nuclear weapons. So it was an idea in the early 60s, late 50s. You know, put the bomb in orbit, and then you can deorbit it when you want to blow something up. There's a treaty that says we won't do that. And there's been an effort to say that space will be reserved for peaceful uses. All countries should have access. No one should be denied access to space. There's a debate over should it be exclusively peaceful uses or just peaceful uses. If I'm up in space and I'm taking a picture, is that peaceful? Space is militarized, but there are no weapons. Getting a treaty that talks about military activity might be more difficult. The Europeans have a code of conduct that lays out things that you don't want to do in space to make it difficult for others, that lays out responsible state behavior. That might be the best we can get, but not everyone has signed up to it.
I ask this a lot, that there's no red phone, there's no de-escalation mechanism in place yet.
People are trying to come up with this mainly because of the debris problem, mainly because of some of the collisions and anti-satellite tests we've seen in the past few years. There's an effort now to share SSA, space situational awareness, so that you can warn people when you think there's going to be a problem. The U.S. tracks objects in space. The Chinese probably do. Do you warn each other? The classic case here was a Russian satellite that was out of commission, deorbited, and on its way down, it bumped into a communication satellite. Oops. And that made people sit up and think, geez, we probably need a way to warn each other when things like this are going to happen. So the awareness part, the sharing of information on debris and on spaceflight patterns, that's going underway. But on the military side, it's still very covert.
We're expecting a lot of good from people on this, I think. It seems that the space question has that built into it from maybe the romance of the space race. But then you look at, say, Congress, who have tied the funding for DoD Space Command, that they need to look into, you know, offensive space control, I think it's called, and defensive capabilities there. When there's money tied to it, when there's research tied to it, does that lead to an inevitability that there'll be some sort of militarization in it in a very real way?
Well, you don't have to do things in space to control space, right? And you don't have to use kinetic weapons to have an effect. And so we all know about directed energy weapons, which the Russians and the Chinese and the Americans have all experimented with. Right now, they could probably blind a satellite or damage components of it. We know about ground-launched anti-satellite weapons or sea-launched anti-satellite weapons. You don't have to put weapons in space to have an effect. You can jam. What if I have a satellite and it parks relatively near your satellite and it emits a radio signal that blocks your satellite from communicating with the Earth? That's not a weapon, right? So there's a lot of ways you can approach this problem. There's a lot of ways you can achieve denial without militarizing space. And I think, unfortunately, more than just those three countries, several countries are looking at how do we interfere with space services, space capabilities? Part of it is the world has realized the U.S. depends on space. It gives it a military advantage. And what they've started thinking is, how do I interfere with that? How do I interfere with reconnaissance, communications, navigation?
Well, how do you defend against that then?
There's a couple approaches. You can complicate the attacker's life. Some people say we should harden the satellites, right? Hard to do because you have a weight constraint, right? It's expensive to put things into space, and there's a limit. Armoring a satellite really doesn't make any sense, right? You can do things to make them jam-proof. The newest generation of GPS has that. But it's very difficult to make the satellite itself a hard target. So you could think about redundancy as another approach, and whether that's smaller satellites that you control, or whether it's contracts with other country satellites, or whether it's some sort of ground-based system, the most public of which might be what they call pseudo-satellites. So a drone flies around and provides communication or reconnaissance or PNT signals. Those are all possibilities. We'll see what we get, but you can make it. The nice thing I like about contracting is, let's say the U.S. and China get into a conflict. We have European satellites for communications. The Chinese have a political decision. Do I want to broaden this conflict by attacking a European asset? That makes it hard for them. So you can make it more difficult to deny space services, but the U.S. needs to do a lot more on that.
We talked a little bit about norms in space, and what may be troubling in the future is the idea of a bad actor not necessarily playing by the rules. You look at China, perhaps in the South China Sea, Russia, maybe in Ukraine, and you kind of get a little scared that maybe, you know, they don't want to play by the rules there. So why should they play by the rules in space? Is there any sort of contingency there? Is there any sort of thinking there yet to try and be able to de-escalate that, or to talk about that before it even comes to fruition?
No. No. Chinese are new to arms control, and so they're fast learners, but it's a new game for them. The Russians are masters of arms control, but they're not too happy with us right now, so can't say discussions are going very well. Even on things like the INF Treaty, things are going the wrong way. So we don't have a good arms control process for space. There's something called the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, COPUS, set up in the UN. It's been talking for 20 years, and talk is good, but it hasn't made much progress. So right now there isn't an arms control solution. Right now the U.S. has to think about how does it build resiliency into the space systems it depends on.
And that's it for me for this year. Thank you for taking the time to listen throughout 2015. 2016 has already shaped me up to have plenty to talk about. We'll be back in the near future, so until then, I always welcome any suggestions you have, topics we may have missed, or subjects you want to dive a little deeper on than we have already. Let me know by emailing cquinn@css.org or getting me on Twitter. It's been a pleasure. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to all.